friends, this is Dr. Beter. Today is July 30, 1980, and this is my audio letter number 56. Yesterday, an emergency session of the United Nations General Assembly came to an end. It was treated as a non-event by the controlled major media of the United States, and many Americans have paid little attention. But it was only the seventh emergency session in the 35-year history of the United Nations. My friends, the stakes involve nuclear war one. The Bolsheviks, who now control the United States government, are determined to bring about nuclear war with Russia one way or another. But their most preferred path to war lies through the Middle East. I first gave details about this nearly 5 years ago in audio letter number 6. Since then, there have been continual revisions and updates of the planning for war by way of the Middle East. I have kept my listeners abreast of these developments in later audio letters, especially numbers 22, 28, 37, and 46. Ever since late 1977, the Middle East war plan has grown to include Iran as a central factor, because the main military strategy of the controlled United States government is now a first-strike strategy, and Iran, nestled against Russia's underbelly, is a tempting base for attack against Russia. But the preferred initial focus of a Middle East war would not be Iran, but Israel. In audio letter 50, I reviewed the common roots of the Zionists who control Israel and the Bolsheviks who now control America. They always work together, hand in glove, because they are derived from the same source. That ancient source was the misnamed Kingdom of the Jews, the Khazar Kingdom, which existed 1,000 years ago in what is now southern Russia. The Bolsheviks and Zionists are identical in their goals and tactics, except for one thing. The Zionist dream is for eventual world domination from Jerusalem, whereas the Bolsheviks want to control their former homeland of Russia and rule the world from there. But the Bolsheviks have largely lost the power they gained in Russia in 1917, and they are now using the United States as their main power base. The Bolshevik-controlled United States is virtually the lone sponsor of Israel. In return, Israel performs many favors for America's rulers, especially in military and covert spy matters. The United Nations emergency session, which just ended, amounted to a referendum by the world against Israel. For years, the Begin government of Israel has been pressing ahead in a relentless program of acts designed to inflame the anger of Israel's Arab neighbors. While protesting loudly that she only wants to be left alone in peace, Israel has been systematically doing the things that can only lead to war. And it is a war which can very quickly engulf the entire world. That is why a majority of the members of the United Nations were worried enough to petition for an emergency session. And after the 6-day debate was over, 112 nations lined up together against Israel. They declared Israel's settlements in the occupied Arab territories illegal and demanded that Israel start pulling out before November 15 of this year. Their common position was summed up by Guinea's United Nations ambassador in the words, "The process of war must come to an end." Israel's ambassador at the United Nations tried to paint the whole debate as a meaningless gesture, even though the United Nations created Israel in the first place. And following the Zionist lead, the Bolshevik-dominated major media here in America treated it as a non-event. The fact is, my friends, that Israeli actions are fast bringing the Middle East to the threshold of war. War fever is rising, and it is being reflected by the thermometer of war, the price of gold. Last January 21, 1980, gold traded at an all-time high of $875 per ounce. And as I revealed that month in Audio Letter 53, A secret nuclear first strike operation was then being attempted against Russia. It failed, and gold prices dropped off for several months. But now, war danger is rising again. The Bolsheviks here are becoming increasingly desperate in their war plans against Russia. If we as a people are ever going to act to save ourselves from final ruin, now is the time we must begin. The stakes are life and death, peace or war. But the key to our own effective action is not military. It lies with the thermometer of war, gold. My three special topics this month are topic number one, Ian Fleming and the Fort Knox gold scandal. Topic number two, narrowing options in the Bolshevik plan for nuclear war. And topic number three, step one in what you can do. Topic number one. Not many years ago, millions were fascinated by the fictional exploits of an imaginary British spy. His name was James Bond, and he was the creation of the late British author Ian Fleming. It was Fleming, more than anyone else, who created the image of the modern super spy. All the Fleming spy stories had two major characteristics in common that made them stand out. For one thing, every story was about a world-shaking situation, which was kept secret from the public. The other common ingredient was always a dazzling display of secret high technologies of every description, things unknown to the public. These two unique features of his stories eventually catapulted Ian Fleming into worldwide fame. He was the undisputed leader in his field. As always happens, many others tried to copy him, and spy stories were all around us in the late 60s. But he always remained one of a kind. Try as they might, none of his imitators could ever match his work. It was as though he had a secret advantage, a secret weapon of his own. And, my friends, he did. In writing his stories, Ian Fleming was drawn upon his own secret weapon. That weapon was knowledge. Fleming had been a high-ranking officer of Britain's cracked intelligence agency called MI5. It was the British who practically invented and perfected the modern concept of intelligence. And to this day, British intelligence remains the equal of any in the world. When Fleming left Her Majesty's Secret Service to become a writer, he was severely limited in what he could publish. He was bound by the restrictions of the British Official Secrets Act. Under that act, Fleming would have been liable for punishment for revealing any official secret without authorization. And so, Ian Fleming, the former British intelligence officer, became what is known as a fictionalizer. That is, he started with factual knowledge, but rearranged and modified it in order to create startling stories of fiction. He was always extremely careful about how he did this. He always knew that he was skirting the fringes of the Official Secrets Act. He could not afford to make a mistake because it would have meant prison for him and possible forfeiture of pension rights. And so he always altered every situation, every secret technology, and every personality enough to avoid revealing actual secrets. It was a long and meticulous process, both to protect himself and to make each final story readable. For that reason, Fleming completed a new James Bond novel only about once a year. If it had all been imagination, as many people believe, he would have been capable of producing a new book every few months, making himself far richer. But because his stories were all rooted in fact, secret fact, he did not dare speed up and run the risk of making a mistake. Ian Fleming had two purposes in writing his famous series of spy novels. One purpose, of course, was to earn a very comfortable living. But beyond that, he was also trying to subtly open the eyes of the reading public by the medium of fiction. Because of the Official Secrets Act, he could not publish the facts that he knew as fact, or without modification. So he did what he felt was the next best thing. and that was to use his stories to open our minds to at least think in terms which were otherwise hidden from us. Fleming truly believed that this was something which somehow had to be done, because knowing what he knew, he was not an optimistic man. More than three decades ago, he could see that the public was beginning to be left behind by secret new weapons, new technologies, and new techniques to enslave us all. A public awakening was the only hope he could see to prevent eventual disaster. And so, beginning in the early 50s, Fleming started writing exciting fiction in order to hint at secret facts. His plan was fictionalized to open eyes. By the early 60s, the one-man campaign of Ian Fleming was starting to gather steam. His fictional hero, James Bond, started gaining popularity in ever wider circles. And even though his exploits were understood to be fiction, people were beginning to think of possibilities which they had never seen before. James Bond movies were in the works. After years of gradual growth, the power of Ian Fleming's fiction was about to explode into a worldwide craze. Countless millions were on the verge of being encouraged to think unthinkable thoughts about what goes on in secret. Simply by encouraging people to think new thoughts for themselves, Ian Fleming was endangering secret plans of very powerful men. And he almost got away with it, because they were slow to realize what he was doing. But just as the James Bond craze was beginning, Ian Fleming's plan was brought to an end. 16 years ago next month, on August 12, 1964, Ian Fleming died an untimely death at age 56. By making us think, Ian Fleming had posed a real danger to secret long-range plans of a powerful few. And even after he was removed from the scene, his fictional efforts to awaken us could not be stopped overnight. The momentum of public interest was just too great, because he had caught the imagination of millions upon millions. The James Bond craze could not be stopped, and so the other choice was to control it. Experts in propaganda and public deception studied the problem and quickly hit on the solution. Fleming's plan had been fictionalized to open eyes. He wanted to make us see possibilities which were being hidden from us otherwise. But with him out of the way, the new plan became fictionalized to close eyes. It was a plan to make secrets more secure than ever by making the truth unbelievable to us. And this technique of blinding us through fiction has been a major factor on the American scene now for 15 years. A perfect example of all of this took place with a book Fleming published 21 years ago, in 1959. It was titled Goldfinger. The starting point for the book was knowledge about certain secrets. Fleming knew that there was a long-range plan to create monetary chaos for private gain and power. He also knew that a central feature of the plan was to be the secret disappearance of America's monetary gold hoard at Fort Knox. And he knew that the kingpin of this international plot was a man with legendary greed for gold. His name? David Rockefeller. It was a plan that was totally unsuspected by the public. It was still the Eisenhower era, the heyday of the so-called almighty dollar. The dollar was good as gold because it was backed by the world's largest monetary gold hoard. Fort Knox was thought to be impregnable. And in those days, my friends, no one dared speak ill of the four Rockefeller brothers. Ian Fleming decided to write a book that would begin to alert people to what was afoot. He could not tell the whole story, nor tell it as fact, because of the Official Secrets Act. But by fictionalizing, he was able to cause people to think of possibilities which would never have occurred to them otherwise. For example, in the 50s, It was a rare American who considered even the possibility of monetary turmoil. The dollar was good as gold, and that was that. Why even think about gold? Individual citizens could not own it, except in jewelry. Wasn't all the rest of it thought to be sealed up in Fort Knox? Everyone knew no one could get in there, and so we didn't even think about it. But in his book, Goldfinger, Fleming brought several key thoughts to our minds. He devised a fictional scheme to show that Fort Knox might not be impregnable after all. He raised the question, what would happen to the dollar and other currencies if the Fort Knox gold were no longer available? And he proposed the unthinkable thought that someone, if they were rich enough and greedy enough, might want to get their hands on America's gold. The actual Goldfinger story, of course, was fiction. But the basic points, which I have just mentioned, were fact. Goldfinger was published in 1959, and barely 2 years later, in 1961, the hemorrhaging of America's monetary gold supply began. Agents of David Rockefeller within the United States government provided a cloak of authority called the London Gold Pool Agreement. And then, for 7 years, until 1968, big army trucks loaded with gold bullion rolled out of Fort Knox constantly, and all without a word to the public. Some of the gold shipments during those 7 years were recorded on a list kept by the United States Mint. Almost without exception, the shipments listed went to the New York Assay Office, where they disappeared without any further accounting. As you may recall, the New York Assay Office was the focus of a scandal in December 1978 involving missing gold. Over 5,000 ounces had simply disappeared. But that, my friends, was a very small tip of a very large iceberg. And so the controversy over the missing millions in gold at the New York Assay Office was quickly smoothed over and covered up. They could not afford to allow any real investigation which might let the public know the truth. According to the official list of shipments I mentioned earlier, a large fraction of America's monetary gold went to the New York Assay Office in the 60s. There it disappeared, never to be seen again. But, my friends, the real situation was even worse. Long ago, my sources gave me hard evidence of many large gold shipments from Fort Knox which were not even listed. 5 years ago this month, in audio letter number 2, I revealed a specific example of this. It was a shipment on January 20, 1965, in which four tractor trailers loaded up at Fort Knox and then headed for railroad tracks across the river at Jeffersonville, Indiana. My sources provided me with details, including photographs of the operation. But the shipment was one of many which did not show on any official government list of shipments. In June 1975, Mr. Edward Durrell and my other associates were able to confront officials of the United States Mint with this example of missing shipments. And for once, the confrontation took place under circumstances in which the Mint was under great pressure to respond. In the most specific terms, the Bureau of the Mint was asked what was shipped out of Fort Knox in the four tractor trailers on January 20, 1965. The written answer, dated June 19, 1975, came from the then-director of the United States Mint, Mrs. Mary Brooks. She confirmed that this unlisted shipment amounted to more than 1.75 million ounces of gold. And, my friends, it was not junk gold melted down from old coins which were confiscated from Americans in 1934. The shipment was part of America's true monetary gold, good delivery gold, which is 0.995 fine or better. After this admission in writing about an enormous secret shipment of gold out of Fort Knox, one would have thought that there would be fireworks, but not so.
My friend Mr. Durrell showered the appropriate officials throughout the government with this evidence of massive fraud at Fort Knox. And he notified the major media and all the appropriate leaders in Congress about this evidence. For reasons which I will explain later in this message, I believe it's time to call attention to one of these people. He is Senator William Proxmire of Wisconsin, chairman of the Senate Banking Committee. Proxmire loves to parade as a great defender of our financial interests in Washington. He's famous for his so-called Golden Fleece Award. Proxmire searches through the federal budget with a fine-tooth comb, and he's always able to find some project or contract which, rightly or wrongly, will look ridiculous to the public. He then trots it out, announces how much it costs, and with a great flourish, gives it his Golden Fleece Award. By this and other means, Proxmire is a master at maintaining his image as a protector of the American economy. But if ever a situation deserved the Proxmire Golden Fleece Award, it is the Fort Knox gold scandal. The petty examples usually chosen by Proxmire fleece the American public out of perhaps hundreds of thousands or $2 million. It makes good publicity for Proxmire, but it's insignificant. By contrast, the Fort Knox gold scandal is fleecing every one of us out of the shirt on our back. It has undermined the dollar itself, which is on its way to destruction. It has set off ever-worsening inflation, even while our economy is stagnating. The gold scandal is fleecing us all. But what has Senator William Proxmire done about that? Let me tell you what he has and has not done. For more than 5 years, Proxmire has been among the top American leaders who have been kept informed about major developments and evidence in the gold scandal. He has been given the evidence I mentioned earlier about the missing shipment from Fort Knox, as well as other evidence of major discrepancies. But up to now, Proxmire has kept his lips sealed about discrepancies about America's gold supply, with one exception. That exception took place in December 1978. Word had leaked out about the 5,000 or so missing ounces of gold at the New York Assay Office, worth over $3 million at today's prices. As chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, Proxmire immediately jumped on the story. Frowning in disapproval, he proclaimed that this would have to be looked into. Hearing those words from the champion of the Golden Fleece Award, the public relaxed and quickly forgot about it. And almost as quickly, Senator William Proxmire made sure he forgot about it, too. To this day, no real investigation has ever taken place over the missing gold at the New York Assay Office. Proxmire's failure to follow up that $3 million gold discrepancy was bad enough. But it's nothing compared to his apparent disinterest in investigating the truth about the Fort Knox gold scandal. The case of the missing Fort Knox shipment is a case in point. At today's prices, that one shipment alone was worth more than $1 billion. Not a mere million, but 1,000 times a million. And that, in truth, was only one example. There were many unreported shipments like that. That is why the Treasury figures, which show a huge remaining American gold hoard, are a fraud, a total fraud. And that's why the United States could auction off only a small amount of junk gold over a period of time, and that had to stop. And that's why the United States dollar is no longer as good as gold. Instead, it's fast becoming worth less than the paper it's printed on. Senator William Proxmire, like many others trusted by the American public, has been given massive evidence about all of this. But his actions so far have helped only those who have taken our own gold in order to fleece us of everything we own. Later in this message, I will have more to say about Senator William Proxmire and the Fort Knox gold scandal. But for now, I want to finish the story of Ian Fleming's aborted efforts to alert the public about things like these. As I already explained, his principle was
fictionalized to open eyes. But after his untimely death in 1964, his stories were seized upon and warped, especially in movies, for the opposite purpose. The new purpose became fictionalized to close eyes. Nothing could be done to alter and neutralize Fleming's books once they had been published. So instead, attention was drawn away from the books to the James Bond movies. And as the movies were in preparation, disinformation agents were planted on the scene to guide the process. As a result, the James Bond who emerged on film was a very different character from the one in Fleming's novels. The basic storylines remained the same, but in many subtle ways, the psychology was radically changed. The movies retained the adventure, fast action, dazzling secret technologies, and bold plots which Fleming had pioneered. But by clever use of satirical humor, every James Bond movie ended up by laughing at itself. Secret weapons were exaggerated or twisted so as to make them entertaining, but also ridiculous. And by filling the movies with strange characters and never-ending gimmicks, viewers were distracted from the underlying warnings of the basic plot. The Goldfinger story was a perfect example of all this. Fleming's original novel called attention to something which most readers would never have thought about otherwise. That was the potential relationship between Fort Knox gold and international monetary chaos. And through his fictional plot, he also planted the idea that the legendary Fort Knox bullion depository might not be invulnerable after all. But these lessons were rarely, if ever, realized by those who saw only the movie. Instead, the typical viewer walked out of the movie laughing. It was obvious that what he had seen could happen only in fiction. And from that point onward, he was programmed to react with disbelief if he should ever hear of tampering with Fort Knox gold. Such a thing could only be fiction. It was just too ridiculous ever to really happen. This is the attitude I encountered more than 7 years ago when I began giving public warnings about deliberate plans for economic chaos. I myself was first alerted to the Fort Knox gold scandal by none other than British intelligence in London after completing a secret mission for Queen Elizabeth in Zaire. And in my book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, I outlined the overall plan, including the unseen role of America's gold. I had one major advantage which Ian Fleming did not have. The United States does not yet have an official secrets act like that of Britain, and so I was not forced to fictionalize. Instead, I was able to give the real plans and real names of those responsible for things to come. The prototype for Ian Fleming's Goldfinger of 2 decades ago was none other than David Rockefeller. And in my book, I showed in detail how he played his kingpin role in the plan to destroy our economy. I described how this was leading to a collapsing dollar, skyrocketing gold prices, a stagnating economy, spiraling financial problems for state and local governments, urban unrest, and eventually nuclear war. But when David Rockefeller himself was interviewed about my book, even he resorted to the technique fictionalized to close eyes. His comment about the conspiracy against the dollar was interesting science fiction. But my friends, the truth is always stranger than fiction. Today, it is fiction that we believe and fact that we don't believe. Most people still believe the fiction that David Rockefeller himself is still alive, but he actually died in a secret coup d'etat nearly a year and a half ago, as I revealed in audio letter 43. What we see today is no longer David Rockefeller, but only his image. My friends, the truth is the truth, no matter what we choose to believe. And what the late David Rockefeller dismissed as interesting science fiction 7 years ago is coming true today. Yesterday, we would not believe. Today, we are suffering. Tomorrow, it will be too late if we do not act now.
This is the end of side one. Please advance tape to the end and turn the cassette over to continue.